Hello, I'm Natalie Charles for the Journal of Neurosurgery Publishing Group. Welcome to the first podcast for Neurosurgical Focus, a free monthly publication available online at thejns.org. March-April is a double issue about stem cells and central nervous system repair. The topic editor is Dr. Nathan Selden, Campagna Associate Professor and Chief of Pediatric Neurosurgery in the Department of Neurological Surgery at Oregon Health and Science University. In November of 2006, Dr. Selden performed the first implantation of purified neuronal stem cells in a human patient in an experimental trial to treat the neurodegenerative disorder Batten disease. In this podcast, Dr. Selden will give a brief introduction to the issue and then speak with Dr. Ole Isaacson of Harvard University about his work in neurotransplantation.
Central nervous system repair holds great promise for treating patients, but also poses some of the most significant challenges for scientists and clinicians. Each time a new biomedical development emerges, that development is typically applied early on to the very significant problem of central nervous system repair. For example, transmitter replacement therapy, trophic factor therapy, and viral-mediated gene therapy have all been applied to the problem of central nervous system repair. But in each case, the results have fallen somewhat short of the anticipation. And so the question emerges, will this latest revolution in biology, the stem cell revolution, fare any better in treating central nervous system disorders? And although there's been a tremendous amount of hype in the field, I think there is some legitimate scientific hope that stem cells may be better suited for central nervous system therapy. For example, stem cells may be able to migrate significant distances within the central nervous system after implantation. In some cases, they can adapt specifically to the host environment posed by different diseases, and they can also potentially recapitulate the appropriate developmental and anatomical fates, such as reestablishing functional synaptic connections. In addition to this scientific complexity, of course, stem cell research poses some thorny ethical problems. We know that proponents of stem cell research and therapy have mostly been concerned with promoting health and life for those who suffer from truly devastating diseases, while opponents are concerned that the creation or destruction of life may be undertaken solely for the purpose of generating and harvesting cells. We know that both sides in this debate are motivated by sincerely held beliefs that certainly deserve respect and attention of everyone involved in the field. Interestingly, during the creation of this issue, dramatic new results emerged from a number of labs around the world, suggesting that therapeutic stem cells or stem cell-like cells may be potentially derived without the use of fetal or embryonic tissue, and we await to see what the potential of this new research will show. Here to discuss these issues with us today is Dr. Ole Isaacson. He's professor of neurology and neuroscience at Harvard Medical School and director of the Center for Neuroregeneration Research at McLean Hospital. Dr. Isaacson, thank you and welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad being here.
Well, the first thing I wanted to ask you about is what is really the primary goal of neurotransplantation research? In general, are we trying to restore connections, or are we trying to interrupt disease processes?
I actually believe both are possible. And the change in thinking, you know, is that while we were taught that pharmacology was the treatment for all diseases, and, you know, L-DOPA was the revolution in neurology, and not much has happened in that field since, actually, but the idea was to replace chemically, as you know, the system. The idea that neurosurgery actually can outcompete pharmacology, as you know, is new. And by putting in a new live nerve cell into the central nervous system of a patient, we have demonstrated, both in patients and in animal model systems, that the living immature nerve cell will hook up with the adult brain, and so therefore creates a much more refined and fine-tuned synaptic connection, which can regulate both releasing of dopamine and sometimes reducing dopamine, of course, depending upon demands of the synapse and circuitry, as you mentioned. So the other aspect of that, which is also in a commentary by Dr. Lozano in your issue, is that while the brain is degenerating, there is transsynaptic changes. And he says, well, you know, is this going to be possible to reconnect circuitry? And I actually do believe that's the case. We have some evidence that once you reconnect the nervous system, you also halt, at least, the downstream transsynaptic changes.
So successful cellular transplantation may not only restore some of the missing transmitters or other molecules, but actually interrupt the process that's causing cell death and degeneration.
Yes, and if I may go further, the reason I really believe that's the case is that what we normally thought of perhaps in medical school or in biology class was that there was transmission systems and then there were trophic systems. We were taught that glial cells were support cells, and we had these two populations, a dichotomous view, if you will. What we're learning recently is that at the very synapse where the transmission takes place, there is a lot of exchange of growth factors. So we used to think of, you know, growth factors such as BDNF and even NGF in other systems being glial derived. But in fact, most of the transmission of those growth factors occur at synapses. And so when we lose a synapse in a system, there is sort of either a paradoxical increase in the growth factor because no growth factor is consumed by the synapse retrograde transport. But also, if you lose a connection, there is a loss of trophic factors downstream. For example, I believe one of the most interesting future research arenas will be growth factor regulations, for example, in the SDN, which many surgeons now operate on with DBS with great effect or at least reasonable outcome for patients. I believe that relay stations like the SDN actually has a lot of trophic changes over time that is part of the disease problem.
Well, that's very interesting, and it raises this issue of transsynaptic degeneration, which of course plays a role in a number of neurodegenerative disorders, including Parkinson's disease, and brings up the question, is Parkinson's disease really a dopaminergic disease, or is it a broader degenerative problem? And what does the answer to this question imply for how we approach stem cell therapy for Parkinson's and potentially for other disorders as well?
Well, so the insight of the year, so to speak, we have in Parkinson's disease something called a BRAC hypothesis, which in its essence is saying that Parkinson's disease is more than a dopaminergic degeneration. The American version of this is actually best described by a physician neurologist, William Langston, Bill Langston in Sunnyvale, California. And I like his interpretation, which is saying, okay, so the dopaminergic degeneration is the tip of an iceberg. And I believe that's a very true thing, namely that as we know, for example, in Huntington's disease, and my lab has done work on that too, once you have a genetic change in a cell, the cell will adapt. And some cells are better than others at adapting to the genetic change. So for those of you who recall, Huntington's disease is an autosomal dominant disease. And practically every cell that we've studied in the body has some reaction to this genetic mutation. But a few cells, and I'm talking about a mere fraction of a percent, have absolutely no way of handling this mutation, so to speak. And eventually, even though it may take 40 years for the cell to completely give up, you know, life, it is a very long and arduous adaptive process. What I'm trying to say is that, for example, the analogy here is that alpha-synuclein, when overexpressed without mutation in the triplication and duplication of gene, is a genetic disease of Parkinson's disease. It generates Parkinson's disease. But that is to say that that alpha-synuclein overexpression is also affecting a number of other systems outside the brain, even in the peripheral nervous system. But I still think that the truth is that the dopaminergic system is the tip of the iceberg, is what we see the patients come into the clinic for that thing called Parkinson's disease. So with the risk of sounding conservative when I'm not, the fact is that it is a dopaminergic problem primarily when we see the patient, and also a problem of the peripheral nervous system, a number of other systems, probably locus coeruleus, etc. But those systems don't break through, so to speak, in a way that causes immediate problems to the patient, although they do participate.
You also raised the issue a minute ago of deep brain stimulation as a neuromodulatory therapy for Parkinson's, which is a very different approach. And I'm curious whether you think that in individual patients, DBS is going to be a competing or a complementary treatment strategy for Parkinson's with stem cell therapy?
Well, you know, I happen to be, even though I'm originally a part of neurology, I met most people who work with me here at Harvard have been in neurosurgery, and they do deep brain stimulation. Many of them are now, you know, were residents and do these treatments in many other places. And I feel that deep brain stimulation is in the same arena as neural transplantation, believe it or not, because it addresses the circuitry change that you brought up when we started our discussion. And it intervenes in a more dramatic way than neural transplantation, not with living tissue, but with, you know, an stimulation or perhaps even a depolarization of circuitry. So I do believe it is actually the modality, that the technique that one should or could use right now in certain patient groups that are still L-DOPA responsive but have, you know, unbearable side effects and so on and so forth. Now, the idea of replacing dopamine upstream of that is actually, to me, in the end, an even more rational approach. But as your issue so well describes, there is simply not a technological advance yet that to say that neural transplantation can substitute for deep brain stimulation. And I also think that maybe we're going to look at different patient groups in the end. One thing we've learned from gene therapy that you also said in the introduction is that they have come short of what we perhaps were hoping, but at the same time, they're making incremental improvements over time. For example, GDNF therapy by AAV viral particles is actually right now in phase one, phase two, but it actually looks quite promising. And what I'm getting at is that they are now giving gene therapy to patients who have had Parkinson's disease of shorter duration. They're not taking cases like were done for neural transplantation. They were so far along that they probably had multiple pathologies. And not only was the dopamine replacement insufficient, but one would have actually had to treat the patient, as we discussed, for neurotrophic reasons, perhaps had much better effect early on. So I think that deep brain stimulation is actually a very reasonable thing to do as it's been used today. But I believe that neural cell, live cell transplantation, and I know a lot of inspired neurosurgeons who see this, when it's fully developed with pure cell preparations from stem cells perhaps, can intervene in the disease process earlier, hooking up the circuitry earlier, preventing transsynaptic changes, and so on and so forth. That's a long scientific and medical road ahead, but I see it very clearly as an opportunity, whereas deep brain stimulation, in my opinion, is already a fully mature technology which cannot be refined much compared to what I was just describing.
That's very interesting, and the issue of how late in the disease course affected patients are when they enter prospective phase one and phase two trials is an important one that we also discuss in the issue, because there is a tendency to take the most desperately ill patients and enroll them in experimental trials, and IRBs are sometimes more happy with that. But of course, as you say, we may be missing the opportunity to treat the disease at a more effective stage.
And you give me an idea, at least I want to take this opportunity, because we rarely get a chance to say this in a public forum, but the real competition is not between DBS and neural transplantation. The real competitive status in medicine is between neurology and neurosurgery, because the day we succeed with neural transplantation or circuitry repair in the earlier patients, it will become a phase shift, a real shift in the way that neurologists will give drugs or potentially compete, in other words, with pharmacological treatments. And that's, I think, when the real battle for the medical future will be.
That's a very interesting perspective, and perhaps we have a little bit of a preview of these kind of issues in the shifts in strategy for treating epilepsy with pharmacological agents and surgery over the last 15 to 20 years.
Uh-huh.
Let me ask you, Dr. Isaacson, what kind of stem cells are most appropriate for human neural transplantation? Should we be putting our energy into embryonic stem cells, differentiated neural stem cells? Should we be looking at stem cells derived from cord blood, or perhaps these very new stem cells, which are derived from adult tissue with sometimes with nuclear transfer techniques.
Well, I'm almost glad I'm not surrounded by my colleagues, because whatever answer I give you now would be contradicted loudly by, you know, any other interested party. So this is just my opinion, consequently. But I must say that having worked with human stem cells and having worked in the stem cell field for the last 12 years, and in parallel had the opportunity to work in the fetal dopamine cell transplantation field, I believe I can say quite firmly that the fetal neural transplantation, so a very well-developed dopamine neuron, you know, at dissected from aborted material or, you know, spontaneously aborted or electively aborted material, prepared in a way that you can inject the cells before they're too mature, doesn't create tumors. It's a very crude preparation presently, but I have seen patients that have recovered for 9 to 14 years. And even though it's the first airplane, if you follow my analogy, it is remarkably successful for what it is. Now, if I take the same, try to get the same dopamine neuron from stem cells, I have to go through a dish. I do this differentiation in my own laboratory, and I can do that, but it's remarkably difficult. But I'm not painting an entirely bleak picture just because I'm pointing out the difficulties, but I do believe that if that is a difficult shift, if I were to take umbilical cord cell to really produce a dopamine neuron that can hook up in the circuitry we just discussed, I think I would need another possibly X number of years to pursue that. And if I had to de-differentiate, say, some other tissue, I may even have, you know, more research time on my hands. So it is a difficult question to answer, and it's full of new data. For example, I could say that I really don't know the answer, because recently in my laboratory and in others, and I've just replicated some results of the skin cell derived stem cells. And I can tell you that these skin cells with appropriate, you know, gene expression changes become very much like the embryonic stem cell. And it's remarkable how successful we have been in making them into dopaminergic neurons. So I would say it's pretty much anybody's guess at this time what will be the most successful product. And it will be something that will be given to neurosurgeons in a way that's practical. I mean, you know, for all the makings of a human stem cell, if it takes in my lab 45 days to grow a human dopamine cell from an embryonic stem cell, that requires a significant biotechnology investment in the future. So it's a very difficult and diverse field with many different competing ideas. But I do not want to forget the key factor, which is that if you want these cells to work better than drugs, I think they need to be normal dopamine neurons. They need to be hooked up and do a little bit more than just, you know, a drug delivery system, because I think you could just as well then use a mechanical device.
Understood. On the ethical side, there's a lot of attention in the media, obviously, to the source of cells, as I alluded to. But I think people are just beginning to think about other really equally challenging, potentially, ethical issues. And so let me ask you one of these. Do you think that stem cell therapy might ever be used for cognitive enhancement rather than treatment of disease? Is that a scientifically realistic possibility? And if so, do you think that that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I guess the answer is no. I don't think that will be used in the future for cognitive enhancement. And the reasons are that the brain, you know, is developed and functionally at a very systems-oriented level, if you will. And adding cells or adding synapses to a system that's very adaptive and connected, basically based on genetics and environment, I don't think it will be a reasonable thing to add more cells, for example. And there is some scientific evidence for that that I think have been overlooked for many years. In fact, in the adult neurogenesis field, which I think is very much in focus, but perhaps not going to have any clinical relevance in the future, if you actually breed mice for increased neurogenesis in the hippocampus, mice that have many neurons in the hippocampus may actually become hyperactive, because if you breed them, say, for running or other physical exercises, they tend to add neurons. But those mice are not very good at cognition. So I think it's very difficult, you know, as a theme to say, oh, let's say that more cells are better than fewer. In the end, I believe the neurobiological concept would be that better connections make for a better function. And, you know, we know that in the dopamine system, if you lose roughly 67% of your synapse component, you get full-blown Parkinson's disease. The year before that, when you had lost 50% of your synapses, you're fine. You are no different by any physical measure that you can take. Although you can see by brain scans that you have changed the levels of dopamine transporter, etc. So I don't think stem cell in any ethical way is any ethical problem in that regard.
So this may recapitulate failure of efforts to improve cognition using pharmacological agents, which in the same way that you describe, I think are summed up by you can't fix a Steinway piano using a sledgehammer.
Yeah, maybe. And I'm kind of, at the same time, I think it's a very reassuring point from this scientific and medical perspective that I don't really think of any scary scenario that anybody can generate. I mean, it's a bit like, you know, the worst case scenario of cloning that the sheep Dolly actually was not a very healthy sheep. So I don't think that people need to be overly concerned about that, and perhaps that will also free them from some of the fears that they may prevent the research.
Well, for the last question, let me ask you, what do you think is the biggest challenge that faces you, specifically in your attempts to improve the lives of Parkinson's patients using cellular therapy, and what's the most alluring and exciting new development that's helping you make progress?
Well, the biggest obstacle is really sort of the day-to-day reality of developing cell therapy. What strikes me year in and year out is that I end up on an issue that usually has to do with that I'm dealing with a living cell rather than, an instrument or a drug. And a lot of what we have to do with living cells, like the transplant surgeons are used to, is that I have to keep the cell alive through processes of differentiation. I cell sort now very actively in my center, and we have developed codes just like the blood transfusion and, you know, hematological field have done, and we've developed codes for sorting cells into different bins, so to speak, for your glial transplantation that you mentioned, perhaps with migratory cells. And you hear quite quickly here that I'm doing a lot of biotechnology of cells that are then going to be transplanted. So technically, my laboratory has probably, you know, in the space that we've done discoveries that may have got more publicity, slowly developed a technology that requires very special techniques. And when we hand over the cell vial to the neurosurgeons, you know, it's a lot of steps involved, including making sure that the cells are viral-free, antigen-free, cytogenetic issues, and so on. So the biggest obstacle in my mind is still the same as for any new technology. It's developing a very new thing that people don't have much experience with. And so every step we take is sort of marred with innovation, if you will, and if you look at it positively. Now, the most tantalizing, you asked me, what's the most tantalizing prospect? I think it comes back to what we talked about in the beginning. The fact that hopefully in near future, if not in the future, I believe we will quickly realize what an enormous structural plasticity the brain has. And for neurosurgeons, it's a very alluring target because I believe we may, with certain techniques, be able to repair very fine circuitry in the future with different levels of difficulty. I believe the dopamine system that I work on now is the relatively easy target for me. It's relatively easy to develop a therapy compared to, say, you know, retinal surgery or thalamic surgery or even some other circuitry that you and I can imagine. So fundamental point is, though, that the nervous system at the adult and even the disease state is very responsive to integrating new cells and synapses, and that for me provides the inspiration to stay in this field and explore it further.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. It's been a delight, and congratulations on your hard work and success in the field thus far.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This concludes our podcast for the March-April issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Thank you for listening. Please join us for the May issue, when the topic will be Radiation Therapy, Current and Evolving Strategies for Non-Malignant Intracranial Tumors. For more information on how to submit your research to Neurosurgical Focus, or to see a list of upcoming topics, please visit thejns.org and click on Neurosurgical Focus. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.